with the sweep and fury of the resurrection. There's a new world a-coming. Today and every Sunday at this hour, WMCA, in cooperation with the Citywide Citizens Committee on Harlem, brings you a series of vivid programs dramatizing the inner meanings of Negro life, based on Roy Otley's prize-winning bestseller, New World A-Coming, starring Canada Lee as narrator. Today's program, written and directed by Mitchell Grayson, is a documentary story of Executive Order No. 8802, which created the President's Committee on Fair Employment Practices.
Executive Order 8802. What does it say? What is its meaning? How did it come about? What does it aim to accomplish? Who's for it? And who's against it? 6 months before Pearl Harbor, it was not uncommon to witness a scene at a factory employment office similar to this.
All right, all right, all right. You'll have to wait your turn, men. Now fill out your application. Give us all the information about what you've done in the past, and we'll get to all of you just as soon as we can.
I'm next, mister.
Okay, I'll take your application.
Here it is.
Your name is Michael Brady?
That's right.
You live in Brooklyn?
Yeah, that's right.
You've been a watchmaker for 3 years, huh?
Nearly 3 years.
Okay, you can start to work immediately at our precision instrument plant in Brooklyn.
Oh, thanks.
Wait a minute. Take this slip of paper to the address marked in it, and you can begin working right away. Okay, next.
I'm next, mister.
Oh. Okay, let me have your application.
Oh, yes, sir.
Henry Johnson, 233 West 137th Street. You live in Harlem, huh?
Oh, yes, sir, but I'm willing to work in Brooklyn, Long Island, anywhere.
Yeah. You're a watchmaker, huh?
For 15 years?
Yeah, so it says here on the application.
And I got the best references from all the places I worked at.
We don't have any jobs open right now. We'll let you know just as soon as we do.
But your advertisement said you needed 100 watchmakers.
Yeah, I know, but, we've got all the men we want. We'll let you know.
Oh, but I'm the second man in line. I've been here since early this morning.
We'll get in touch with you when something shows up. Next! Okay, Johnson, go on, move along. Next man, step along. All right, let's have your application.
This Negro watchmaker turned away and walked toward the door. The personnel supervisor, who said there were no more jobs available, wrote on the application reason for his statement. One word. Colored. Yes. 6 months before Pearl Harbor. Some Negroes, possessing in some instances better experience and work records than whites, were being turned away from war plants because of their color. In the New York area, a government survey revealed
of 29,215 employees in 10 war plants, only 142 were Negroes.
In St. Louis, in 56 war contract factories, each plant employed an average of 3 Negroes.
In Texas, of 17,435 available war jobs, 9,117 were barred to Negroes. In Michigan, of 26,904 war jobs, 22,042 were barred to Negroes.
Throughout the United States, more than 50% of all war industries flatly refused to hire Negroes. An outbreak of seething discontent flared up in the Negro population.
What kind of a democracy is this? They'd pull my son to take him to the army to fight for America, but I'm told that I can't help to make guns for him. Let's go to Washington. Our government ought to know that this industry is blocking the total war effort.
I just heard a shortwave broadcast from Japan. The way those Japs are laughing at the treatment of Negroes in America, at American democracy. I tell you, we ought to get rid of discrimination and prove that they're wrong.
My husband. husband just joined the army. I wanted to help in the war effort, so I applied for a job at the sewing factory. They said that since I was working as a housemaid, they couldn't give me the job. They said if women like me got defense jobs, there'd be a shortage of maids.
I've lived in this town for 52 years, since I was born. I'm a painter. I was unemployed, and although painters were in great demand, they didn't give me the job. They brought in a bunch of men from another state, and they got the jobs.
That was how the job situation for Negroes appeared in the early spring of 1941. In New York, at the office of the National Association for the Advancement of Colored Peoples, a distinguished Negro labor leader, A. Philip Randolph, came to visit Walter White, executive secretary of the association.
Philip, have you looked through that pile of letters on my desk?
Yes, I have.
What do you think of it?
Serious.
I tell you, we must not take this thing lying down.
I agree with you. It's just shocking.
We're continually flooded by calls from people and letters. Individuals even stopped me on the street, all of them bitterly complaining against the rotten Jim Crow discrimination they're coming up against in war factories.
Yes, I know. It grieves me so deeply that I'm beginning to think that we've just got to have a Senate investigation of this entire matter and settle this thing once and for all.
I'm sure the president is with us, but we ought to put some real pressure on Washington.
I think I know how it can be done.
How?
A march on Washington. You see, one individual parading up and down in front of the White House denouncing racial prejudice will mean nothing. But if we were to organize a march on Washington with 50,000 people in a peaceful yet a mass demonstration, I think that that would command respectful attention.
It would take a lot of organization.
Well, we could charter special trains, hire a caravan of buses, even hitchhike. We've got to let the whole country know about this issue. We'll make it work.
I'm with you, Philip. 100%.
Not long after, White, Randolph, and others, influential Negro leaders, were called to Washington by the President of the United States. As a result of this meeting on June 25, 1941, President Roosevelt issued Executive Order 8802. The President's Proclamation. The first presidential order affecting minority racial groups directly since Lincoln's Emancipation Proclamation. Created the Fair Employment Practices Committee.
I do hereby declare that it is a duty of employers and of labor organizations to provide for the full participation of all workers in defense industries without discrimination because of race, creed, color, or national origin. And all contracting agencies of the government of the United States shall include in all defense contracts hereafter negotiated by them a provision obligating the contractor not to discriminate against any worker because of race, creed, color, or national origin. Signed, Franklin D. Roosevelt.
By this order, democracy was extended not alone to all colored Americans, but to 5 million Jews, 5 million aliens, 6 million foreign-born citizens, 1 million Orientals and American Indians, 5 million Spanish-speaking peoples, and to all minorities. Then, almost immediately after the order was put into effect, complications set in.
Oh, excuse me, mister. Is this the Chicago Defense Housing Project?
Nothing else but.
Well, I heard there were jobs here for steam fitters.
You a steam fitter?
Yes, sir.
There's jobs here for steam fitters.
Well, can you put me to work?
You a member of the Steam Fitters Union?
Well, no, I'm not a member.
Well, if you're not a member of the union, then you can't get a job here.
Well, how's that?
The union's got an agreement with the contractor on this project to hire only union men.
Well, I'm willing to join if I can get the job.
Well, you'll have to see them about it. I can't hire you unless you're a member of the union.
Yes, sir? Can I help you?
Well, my name's Lawrence, Jim Lawrence.
Yes, Mr. Lawrence.
Well, I went over to the Chicago Defense Housing Project looking for a steam fitter's job. I'm a steam fitter. And they said I couldn't work unless I was a member of the union.
Yes.
Well, I went to the union office and tried to join up. But they don't admit Negroes into that union.
Then what happened?
Well, then I came here. This is the right place to come, isn't it? The President's Fair Employment Committee?
That's right, Mr. Lawrence. I'm going to ask you to put your complaint in writing and sign it. We'll investigate it and do what we can to help you. My name is Mary Forsythe. I'm with the President's Committee on Fair Employment Practice.
Well, howdy. I'm Tim Smith, the union delegate.
Mr. Smith, I've been investigating a complaint of discrimination filed by a Negro steamfitter, Jim Lawrence.
A complaint? Against the union?
Yes, Mr. Smith.
Well, now, how can a Negro complain of discrimination in our union? We don't have any Negroes in the union to discriminate against.
That's just it. The contractor tells me he's willing to hire Negroes if they can do the work.
Now, wait a minute. He can't do that. He's got an agreement with us saying he can't use anybody except members of our union.
As far as the government housing project is concerned, your union policy is not in line with Executive Order Number 8802.
Well, look here, ma'am. Are you telling me that...
You just don't seem to realize you live in a democracy. And Negroes are being drafted like everyone else. There's a presidential order and a clause in your contract which forbids discrimination against workers in defense jobs because of race. Your union will have to change its policy.
Well, we'll have to hold a meeting on that.
By all means, if it will help clear up the issue. And if it will make matters simpler for you, I could tell you what another union recently did on the same subject.
Yeah? What union?
The Railway Mail Association. For 27 years, it refused to admit colored members. And only recently, it broke down the barrier. Negroes were voted into the loco. And now everybody has agreed that they are excellent union members.
That so? Well, I'll see what can be done.
The outcome of this Chicago incident was satisfactory. Negroes soon went to work on the government housing project. Very shortly after that, 22 AFL and CIO unions and locals pledged themselves in a statement to the government to fight anti-Negro discrimination in war industry by helping to place Negro workers. In the larger picture, though, labor unions have been the least offenders charged with discriminatory practices. Highest on the list, with approximately 63% of all complaints lodged against it, is private industry. Here's an FEPC investigator, Ben Wilson, and the shipyard manager, Harvey Milgram, in a typical interview regarding the employment of Negroes, which will give you many reasons why a number of employers refuse to hire Negroes.
Now, look here. I've said it before, and I'll keep on saying it. Negroes just can't do the work.
Well, I'm sorry to disagree with you, Mr. Milgram, but the opposite is true. We have proof of it since many companies have changed their policies regarding discrimination.
Mr. Wilson, take a look out the window at our shipyard. There are thousands of men on the job and not one is colored. There's a reason for it. I say they can't do the work.
I said we have proof, Mr. Milgram. There are more than 6,000 Negroes working as machine operators, riggers, drillers, chippers, caulkers, blacksmiths, and a dozen other jobs.
Where?
At the Newport News Shipbuilding and Dry Dock Company and elsewhere.
Well, suppose they do work elsewhere. They're not going to work here. The men who work in this shipyard would quit before they'd work alongside Negro workers.
You're saying that whites and Negroes won't work together, is that it?
That's right.
The simple truth is that Negroes and whites do work together.
Well, they wouldn't in this shipyard. I tell you that in advance. There'd be trouble here.
Trouble? With whom?
With our workers.
Have they said so?
No, I say so.
Well, Mr. Milgram, would you yourself object to having Negro workers?
Well, no.
if they were competent and didn't cause trouble.
Well, I've been handling a lot of complaints. I don't find many men, that is, union officials or employers, who say that they object to any kind of workers. They say, like you, that other people will object, workers, the public. But I think most Americans are fair-minded. I think that you people who are afraid only of shadows.
Well, we've never put Negroes on machines. It'll be a new thing. Besides, we're only interested in production.
Well, Mr. Milgram, employment of Negroes doesn't have to upset production at all.
Now, listen, you don't know anything about this shipyard.
You haven't felt the labor shortage yet, but you will. Men are being drafted into the armed services. The draft will certainly affect this shipyard.
Well, until it does, I won't worry about it.
Yeah, it may be too late then. Your production schedule may be seriously delayed. You may even lose some government war contracts because you won't be able to fill them. Now, unless you employ qualified Negro workers and train hundreds of additional Negroes, just as you train white men and women, this shipyard may not reach full production.
Well, I can't change things overnight. You'll have to give me some time.
Things certainly changed a lot overnight. Milgram and a lot of other Americans went to bed that night, December 6, 1941. Woke up the next morning, had their usual Sunday breakfast, went to church, came home, and turned on the radio to listen to some soft music. The music was interrupted. You know the rest. Pearl Harbor, and America was at war. At first, gradually. Then in large numbers, Negroes began to get into war jobs. Large companies even began to upgrade Negro workers who had never before been given a chance to work on complicated machines. Colored women were brought into war industries. But still, there were a few companies which refused to abide by the letter and spirit of the president's executive order 8802.
I just don't want to be told how to run my business.
I think you're missing the point. We're not suggesting to you how to run your business.
Mr. Wilson, I've built this aircraft plant from scratch. Until today, it's one of the largest in the United States. I'm doing more war work than most of my competitors. I need more help. All I did was ask the United States Employment Service to send me 30 girls for assembly work.
Yes, 30 white girls.
That's right, 30 white girls.
Unless you request 30 qualified girls, regardless of color, you're discriminating. And the government won't help you do it.
I won't be told how to run my business.
Well, just what have you against Negroes?
Just that I resent being told who I must hire and fire.
Well, we are not telling you who to hire and fire. But for the good of the total war effort, you must make use of all people who can do the job.
Mr. Wilson, I'm not in the mood to discuss principles with you.
The only principles we are concerned with is eliminating discrimination, putting people to work regardless of race, color, creed, or national origin.
I won't hire Negro girls in my plant. Now, if you're so anxious to help the war effort, send me 30 white girls.
Of course, the United States Employment Service refused to cooperate with this employer. And a short time later, when he was desperately in need of more help, he came around to the FEPC.
All right, you win. I need the help. I'll take all the workers the employment service can send me. White, black, or any color.
That wasn't the end of the incident either. When finally the employee accepted assembly workers without discrimination, he found that qualified Negroes were just as efficient as anyone else he'd employed. Then he said he'd make a public statement.
Yes. I'm ready to make this statement to anybody. I learned the hard way. Well, I'll admit that I made a mistake. I'm hiring all the help I can get now. And all that I ask is that they can do the work. It's the best way in the long run. It's the only American way.
That's pretty much the way most industries feel about hiring today. Yet there still remains some. Not quite as many as before, who practice un-Americanism at home, while their sons overseas are fighting and dying for democracy.
These individuals are bolstered by the remarks of a small group of United States senators in Congress, one of whom you shall hear in a moment. His name is Senator Bilbo, senior senator from the state of Mississippi.
I rise to speak against the FEPC. Many persons in this country are coddling and playing up to the Negro in order to secure his vote. Personally, or in any other way, I am not interested in the Negro voting. The Negro does not vote in my state, and he's not going to vote within a long, long time. Congress may pass all the anti-poll tax legislation it wishes to pass, but the Negro is not going to vote in my state at this time.
Senator Bilbo, to the contrary, votes were not the issue with regard to the FEPC. The issue was made clear by Senator James Meade, Democratic senator from the state of New York, who rose to challenge the senator from Mississippi.
Mr. President, Pearl Harbor came, and with it congressional authorizations beyond the imagination of man for the production of war materials and equipment, the like of which the world had never before visioned. Then the president, in the acute emergency, the most serious crisis in all the history of our country, was called upon to take necessary action. He created the Fair Employment Practice Committee in order that every available man and woman who was eligible might become a part of the great war-producing machinery of the nation. Millions of citizens until that time could not make their full contribution. There were factories and industries and machines of all kinds. There were millions of workers. And yet there was a discriminatory labor policy that kept them miles apart. This agency is consistent with the principles upon which our government was founded. Our advocacy of the rights of minority groups has helped us in our relations with other countries, and it will continue to help us at the council tables when the foundations of the peace are laid after the war. Mr. President, no American should be discriminated against. America is a free land where all men should be treated as free citizens. I shall vote in favor of the FEPC in order that America and all its citizens shall remain free.
At the close of the debate, the Fair Employment Practices Committee was voted congressional approval. Today, businessmen, labor leaders, working men and women, both Negro and white, are pushing toward the main objective of sustaining this great democratic agency after the war. The leader in the fight for its continuance after the war is still President Franklin Delano Roosevelt, who recently said,
"Our economic Bill of Rights, like the sacred Bill of Rights of our Constitution itself, must be applied to all our citizens, irrespective of race, creed, or color." In 1941, I appointed a Fair Employment Practice Committee to prevent discrimination in war industry and government employment. I believe that the Congress should, by law, make that committee permanent.
Thank you.
This program was written by Mitchell Grayson and is based on Roy Otley's prize-winning bestseller, New World A-Coming. Featured in today's cast were Canada Lee as narrator, Muriel Smith as Mary Forsythe, Frank Wilson as Jim Lawrence, Fred O'Neill as Ben Wilson, Joe Bolin as Tim Smith, Martin Wolfson as Senator Meade, Sanford Bickert as the aircraft manager, and George Randall as Walter White. Next week, New World A-Coming will present Barbara Layton's story of an experience in Harlem Hospital with an all-star cast, including the star of Bloomer Girl, Celeste Holm, the star of Anna LaCosta, Hilda Sims, the star of Carmen Jones, Muriel Smith, and the star of New World A-Coming, Canada Lee. Music for today's broadcast was by James Lizito, conducted by Jerry Sears. This is America's leading independent station.